Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Today's guest is Terry Coates. He is an alum of MTSU, graduated with a bachelor's in art education, and he is also president of the Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis Railway Preservation Society, one of the co-founders of it. His book, which is 4 years in the making, is Next Stop on Grandpa's Road, History and Architecture of NC and St. L. Railway Depots and Terminals. It's chock full of information about the origins of the railway and also photographs of the depots and terminals in Alabama and Tennessee, some of which still exist and some of which do not. We will talk about the lore and romance and reality of the railway with Terry Coates. Welcome, Terry. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation to come.
Thank you. This book that you spent 4 years working on, how many people were you able to track down who actually had worked for the railway or had some direct connection with the railway in order to get information about it?
The NC and St. L. Railway went out of business in 1957. Technically, it merged back into the L&N Railroad in August of 57. But there are quite a few old members of the society that still are still in existence, and I've talked to some of them, go to some reunions, and I've been able to talk to men there, and there are quite a few still left.
So what were some of your other sources?
To research the book, we traveled, my wife and I traveled as far up as Hickman, Kentucky, which was one end of one of the divisions of the NC and St. L. Railway, as far down south as Atlanta, Georgia, which would have been the other end of that one of the divisions. And we actually made two trips to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. and College Park, Maryland to do research and to gather photographs for the book. I've been to the Atlanta Historical Center in Atlanta to get information, say, on the terminal that was in Atlanta and some other things like that.
What makes the North Carolina and St. Louis, Nashville, Chattanooga, I see NC and I want to say North Carolina, Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis Railway special to you, more so than any other rail line?
I actually never worked for any railroad. I was a 30-year veteran of the Nashville Metro Police Department, but I grew up in a little town in the northwest corner of Tennessee called Dresden. It's where Ned Way McCorder was from, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
We lived about, no more than 200 or 300 yards from the train station, and when I was around 8 or 9 or 10 years old, I stayed at the train station all the time, just pestering the snot out of the old man that ran the station and the agent. I remember from my youth the NC and St. L. trains that were still coming through Dresden at that time. Now, you've got to remember that the railroad went out of business in 57, but the L&N did not repaint the NC and St. L. NC and St. L. engines and freight cars until much later, or maybe never did until they were demised. But so I remember even in the late 1950s that the trains were still carrying the NC and St. L. logos and especially the paint colors. So I had a love for the NC and St. L. railroad from my youth.
The railroad is something that somebody of my age barely remembers because it's something that you might hear your grandparents talk about, but it's something that has seemed to pass a great many of us by in the digital age. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, but first, give us just a brief description, if you will, of the fellow named Vernon Stevenson, who seems to be, from your talk in Bedford County the other day, both the hero and the villain of this story, which is odd to find in one guy being both the hero and the villain.
In the late 1830s, early 1840s, Tennessee was trying to develop an infrastructure, i.e. to build railroads in this state, and they were looking for people to start up railroad companies. Now, Vernon Stevenson was actually a businessman in Nashville. I'm not exactly sure what his business was, but when he saw that there was a need for railroad companies to start up, he bid on the idea of of being the one to start one in Nashville. There was a need for a railroad to be built between Nashville and Chattanooga, and so he actually solicited funds from the people in Nashville. It's my understanding that he actually walked from door to door, pounding on everybody's door that lived in Nashville, and raised over $500,000 to get the railroad started. He went on to Charleston, South Carolina, and actually knocked on doors over there and got $500,000 over there. So between those two cities, he actually got about $1 million to start up the company. They would charter the railroad in 1845 and actually start construction around 1848, going toward Chattanooga from Nashville. He's going to go on to be the president for a number of years. They will elect him at the first board meeting. They will elect him to be the first president, and he will serve in that position for a number of years.
And he was, how could somebody be both a Confederate and a carpetbagger at the same time?
Well, when the war breaks out in 1861, he's going to take on the responsibility appropriate the job of being a quartermaster for the supplies that are stored there in Nashville. You've got to understand that Nashville was a big supply depot, being that we were supplying the armies in Kentucky and in Middle Tennessee and in Tennessee from there. And he was elected or appointed to be the quartermaster. When Fort Donelson falls and Nashville's fixing to fall right behind it, he will literally abandon his position as quartermaster for the Confederate government, and he has an NNC train sitting in Nashville waiting to ferry his wife, his carriages, his fine furniture, and horses and everything else out of Nashville. So when Nashville's about to fall, he actually backs a train up there and loads his good stuff on it and abandons the city and abandons his position as quartermaster there in Nashville.
What a prince of a guy.
Well, you got to love him for starting a railroad, but then after the war, he's going to go up to New York and become a New York banker and sit up there high and dry away from the chaos of the Reconstruction in Middle Tennessee.
Totally pragmatic. I wonder why he didn't run for public office.
Yeah, maybe he did.
How was it determined where the railroads would go? Was it strictly on the basis of need, or was there a certain amount of politicking involved insofar as which cities and counties would get terminuses and which would not?
In actuality, Vernon Stevenson and a man named Thompson, who was at the time an engineer for the Georgia Railroad, which was building it across Georgia about the same time, he got Mr. Thompson away from the Georgia Railroad, and he and Vernon Stevenson and himself actually rode horseback from Nashville to Chattanooga and plotted out what they would consider the best route to build the railroad that they were going to build between those two cities. If you drive down I-24 today, if you come through here, through Murfreesboro here, and then go on down through Tullahoma and then on down, as you all know, you'll dip down, you'll cross the Cumberland Mountain, and you'll dip down into Georgia and then come back up to get to Chattanooga. That's the way I-24 goes today, and that's the actual route that Vernon Stevenson and Mr. Thompson laid out in the 1840s when they were laying out for this railroad. Thompson decided that's the best way to get the railroad across. There was another entrance into Chattanooga, but they just chose to go down around the base of the mountain by going through Georgia to get back to Chattanooga.
Did the federal government lay out the interstate that along that route on purpose? Did they know what they were doing?
Well, I think they just knew that Thompson was right from the 1840s and knew that was the best route to get around the base Raccoon Mountain outside of Chattanooga and to get around the base of Lookout Mountain to get back up into Chattanooga.
Yeah, why reinvent the wheel, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. I remember when I was in first grade, our class was taken on a little train excursion from Shelbyville to War Trace. Shelbyville, when you were telling the story in Bedford County about the extent to which the train went into Bedford County, there were some people who wanted it and some people who didn't years before I was born. Tell that story.
Well, when Thompson and Vernon Stevenson were laying out the little path through what would become what was Bedford County, they people in Bedford County did not want the smell, the noise, the smoke, the confusion, and maybe even the bad elements that they thought would come off the train. So they refused to let Stevenson and them put the train tracks, the layout of the railroad, through the middle of Shelbyville. So they actually would skirt the very bottom corner, and we would run between Tullahoma and, say, Cowan, and skirt the outside of Bedford County. The people in the county didn't necessarily want the train, but the people in Shelbyville, downtown, the people of the city of Shelbyville actually did want the train, so they wound up going to Vernon Stevenson and asking if he could build an 8.5 or 9 miles or so branch between Shelbyville and what would become the main line down in the lower corner of Bedford County. So they, at the same time that the UNC was building the main line between Nashville and Chattanooga, they also built a little short spur between Wartrace and Shelbyville, and a little 8 mile branch up through there.
And the depot does still exist, but it's used for adult education classes and that kind of thing. But by the time I came along, I don't think they were using it for commerce. They were just using it for these little excursions for school children and maybe visitors and that
yes,
kind of thing.
Yes, they've used that station for several different used the facility for several different reasons. And as of a few years ago, they did refurbish it, and it looks pretty nice down there now.
Why do the depots and terminals have so many different styles of architecture, and the buildings look so different each in its own place? There's no corporate style cookie cutter look to them, which is a wonderful thing. But how do you account for that?
Well, actually, there actually was a cookie cutter style. There were two cookie cutter styles on the NC and CNL Railway. There were this Carpenter Gothics that were started around the 1870s, lasted, let's say, through the 1890s. And then there was a Queen Anne style that started about the same time, about the time the other one was playing out, about the 1890s, and went through about 1920s. Now, we did this because the general taste of the American architecture was doing basically the same thing. Our houses were still following the Carpenter Gothic Revival style of architecture in this country. So the railroads actually formed a simplified version of Gothic Revival's architecture and formed it into their architecture, into their stations. And then when our taste changed in this country and we went to a Queen Anne style, the NC and CNL and some other railroads as well would develop and adopt a Queen Anne style of architecture. Now, to kind of rephrase on what you were saying a minute ago, we actually do have an awful lot of different style of railroad architecture on the NC and CNL railway. That's because we inherited an awful lot of railroads from other companies. After the Civil War, these companies that had just gotten their heads above water just before the war or been devastated by the war and are in very poor financial shape, they are going to go into foreclosure by the state of Tennessee for loans that were given to them in the 1850s, and they will default on those loans. Two companies, the NC and CNL, the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad and the LNN Railroad, who were the two largest companies still with their heads above water in the state, will buy out these railroads. So if you look at a map of the NC and CNL Railway in 1957, the railway was going to cover about 1,200 miles, as I indicated, from Hickman, Kentucky, all the way down to Atlanta, from Paducah down through Jackson, through to Memphis, and a big blob of it down in North Alabama. If you were to get on, say, a motor car and just travel those lines, you're going to see an awful lot of architecture, different styles of architecture, and that was because we had inherited a lot of these different companies after they went into foreclosure. We inherited their stations as well as their track and as well as their equipment. And each company had developed its own kind of architecture before we got a hold of it, and we being the NC and CNL Railway. So you're going to find some similarities between those Carpenter Gothics and those Queen Annes, but mostly there's just an eclectic collection of different kinds of architecture across the system because we inherited those stations from them.
When you look at the photos, and the book is chock full of photos of depots and stations past and present, you see some that look like little bitty shacks, some that look almost like New Orleans shotgun houses, the ones that are made out of stone, some of them have arches. This one in Lebanon looks like somebody's three-story house. It looks almost like a mansion.
Well, that one came off what was the old Nashville and Knoxville Railroad, and that mansard roof building there stood from the 1870s, I would think, until about 1971 when that thing burnt one night as an arsonist got a hold of it. But again, that depot, as I indicated a while ago, was inherited from one of the other railroads that we took over at some point, generally around the 1870s. And so you had this eclectic collection of different kinds of stations and different kinds of architecture. Now, the reason that some of these stations were small, some of them large, it depended on the population of the town. At some point, a town might have been small, and the NC could not justify putting a good sized station there with a paid agent on duty all the time. So they would have just put up what one might be considered like a bus shelter today, a small shelter that just to get you out of the rain. Sometimes they were just passenger stations, sometimes passenger shelters, and sometimes they were actually freight and passenger shelters. So they would have been split in half, and you would have had a place to put suitcases and small boxes and things like that. The other half of it was that. As the town got a little larger, they might have actually been qualified to get a bigger station and would justify buying having an agent there. So they would build a larger station at that point. Sometimes it went the other way around. Sometimes the population of a town would move away. They couldn't justify keeping a full-time agent there anymore, so they would tear down the big station and build one of the small shelters.
Would it be fair to say that Nashville's Union Station was the most grandiose station, or were there others in urban areas that were more elaborate?
Well, around
more ornate.
Around 1870, Cornelius Vanderbilt is going to want to showcase his New York Central Railway and another railroad up there in New York, and so he's going to build what we might consider in this country the first grandiose terminal in New York State, New York City, and New York State. And then you would have these other railroads that kind of followed suit around the late 1870s. These massive, grandiose train stations, terminals, start popping up all over the country. Some of them are still in existence. One bringing to mind is the St. Louis, Missouri train station that was built around that time. The station in Nashville, the terminal station that's still there on Broadway, at 10th and Broadway, was built in 1900. It was a combined effort between the L&N Railroad and the NC and C&L Railway. It replaced an old station that had been built in 1854 in what we call the Gulch right there under Broadway and through that area where the trains run through. There was a station there that was built as we were building the Nashville and Chattanooga Railway in 1854.
Tell me about the Murfreesboro station. There is still one down there by the tracks close to Bridge Avenue.
Right.
Is it still in basically the same shape as it has been, or has it been revamped and revitalized?
That building was built in 1890, either 93 or 96, I can't recall, but somewhere right in that area. In fact, the cupola on the end of the building still has the date on it. That building is basically as intact as it was built in 1893. There were a couple of ornate dormers up on the roof of the building. They're not there now, but the station as you see it today and the little freight station that accompanies it are just as they were one might have seen in 1893 when the place was built.
Is that due to the work of preservation societies?
Well, that's due to the fact that the NC and C&L used the station all the way up through 57. The L&N used it all the way through through their demise in the 1980s or 1990s. And then the CSX Railroad used the station until that was a manned station. There was still an agent there until about the middle of last year and through about this time in 2009.
Well, there are always cars parked in front of it. There are still people going in and out of that building.
Well, that's because the CSX Railroad, the current owner of the railroad through Murfreesboro here, still uses it for maintenance. The way they keep supplies and other materials in there.
No.
Now, when I was in college here in 1973, there was a station that was just further down the track, just to the south of the current station, that was built in before or just about the time of the Civil War. That building stayed here through I got out of college in 73, and it was still here when I was here. I don't recall visiting it much, but I do remember seeing it on down the track down there.
Mm-hmm. How many of these depots and stations still exist? Do you know?
My documentation was that there were somewhere between 250 and 300 train stations built along the 1,200 miles of train track that was the NCNCNL Railway. Today, I can document that there are still somewhere between 65 and 70 train stations. There's an old roundhouse still in Brewston or Hollow Rock, Tennessee. There is a couple of other, like a switch towers and some other things along the line, but I can document about 75 structures on the NC that are still standing, and that does not include the section houses. When the men whose job it was to keep the maintenance way up on the railroad were given company housing, and they lived in what was called section houses along the right of way.
I was going to ask you about that. If any railway personnel actually lived in the depots and stations, just to make sure that they were manned 24/7.
There were. On some other railroads, you might have found the architecture to contain a second story on the buildings. We had a couple of stations that were two stories, but the station agent never did live, as far as NCNCNL employees, did not live on the second floors. Now, that's not to say that they did not do that on some other companies, but we did not have a station agent that lived on premises that I can recall.
Mm-hmm. If it was a snowy night, they might have gotten snowed in and spent the night there. But, just an anomaly.
Right.
Yeah. tell me a little bit about, during the Great Depression, did the NC and St. L. also have as much concern with hobos riding the rails as any other railway did?
As much as any other railway did. The Depression hit pretty hard against the NC and St. L. as it did every other company, and they were forced to close some of their lines down. Some of the branch lines shut down, at least temporarily, during the war. During the Depression, and they tried their best not to lay off anybody, and I think they did keep that to a minimum, but I think they were actually forced to cut back on the personnel as well.
Well, did they have railway police trying to chase off people who would try to ride the rails?
Yes, in fact, they did. I'm currently writing a story about a police officer in Memphis, a railroad detective for the NCNCNL Railway that was killed in 1935, trying to protect a boxcar full of cigarettes down in the Memphis train yard.
No. Just a boxcar full of cigarettes.
Yeah, he had had trouble with a couple of hobos that earlier in the night, and they tried to break into a caboose, and the caboose conductor called the attention to the railroad detective, and he went off to find the thing, and about 4 or 5 minutes after he talked to the conductor on the caboose, they heard this bam, 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 and this two men and the detective had got in a gunfight down there in Memphis, and the officer got shot 5 times and killed him.
Oh, my gosh. Well, why, given, and I know Amtrak has had its troubles and it's had to fight for congressional funding every year, but
yes.
Why you have to go to Atlanta or New Orleans to make an Amtrak connection? Why, given the romance of the railroad in the South and how important, why doesn't it go to more places in the South?
Well, romance is one thing, economy and financing and business is another.
But it goes all over the place in the Northeast.
Well, but you look at your population, and the concentration of the population, say in Philadelphia, New York, in Washington, D.C., and even up into New Jersey, you've got such a high concentration that you've got to move people. You couldn't put that many cars on the road up in the Northeast quarter. So you have to have high speed rail up there, and eventually it may be not not in my lifetime, or maybe in the latter part of my lifetime. I'm 60. But sometime we will get some high-speed rail through here. They're actually talking about high-speed rail between here and Chattanooga as we speak. So,
have you ever read any of the bullet trains in Europe or Japan?
I did, in fact, ride the bullet train from London to Paris about 3 months after the tunnel opened.
What was it like? What did you think of it?
Well, we left London going toward Paris. We hit French soil, and we were doing 100. The conductor came on and said we're doing 187 miles an hour. And I looked out the window in sheer disbelief, because that car was as quiet as this radio studio that we're in right now, and it was as stable as the floor under us right now. I was so impressed with the car that I was riding in. I actually got out and made pictures of the suspension system under the car. So we were hitting 187 miles an hour when we hit French soil, and I thought I was sitting dead still.
Were you comfortable?
Oh, it was a marvelous experience. Yes.
Did you eat on the train?
No, you don't. It's only about
it's
a two and a half hour. It's about a 2.5 hour ride.
Not enough time even for salted peanuts.
Yeah, that's true.
Why in this country have we been so behind the curve when it comes to having high-speed commuter rail all over this country, from coast to coast, or at least from town to town, city to city, within a state?
Well, I've traveled extensively in Europe on trains, and you're talking about, you know, you're talking about the country of Great Britain being the size of one of our states, or France being the size of one of our states, and even Europe is, you know, and combined all the countries in Europe is only as large as a portion of our country. This is a vast country. You know, we're 3,000 miles from coast to coast, and it just, you can't qualify, you know, putting as many trains in service as we do in England or in France. I've had friends come over here, and they think that, you know, they say, well, I want to be in San Francisco tonight, and Denver the next night, and New Orleans the next night. They just have no comprehension of how large this country is and how long it takes to get across it. And likewise, it takes our trains. I mean, if you leave, even on Amtrak today, if you leave San Francisco, it's 55 hours back to Chicago, to the middle of the country. So it's a long, arduous process to drive by train.
In the urban areas, though, we've had subways ever since the early part of the 20th century. You know, it seems like within a city we can manage a transportation system like that by rail, but we can't do it regionally even, or within a state.
Well, we're making inroads. We have the Music City Star that comes from Lebanon, and we've got some MTA out of Nashville. They've got bus routes up maybe to Clarksville and to Gallatin. And
Bob Clement had been working on light rail for goodness knows how long.
Yes.
When he was in Congress.
Yes. You know, if we're going to put a passenger train on in the state of Tennessee, it's got to run along along with the freight trains.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in England, in Europe, you've got dedicated lines. You don't run the freight trains on the same track that you run your passenger trains on. We don't do that in this country. And so our freight companies, the CSXs and the Norfolk Southerns and the UPs and so on and so forth, they just don't want to have to, if a passenger train's coming through, they've got to take their freight train and put it on the sidetrack to let the passenger train come through. And so they just don't want to play railroad with the passenger companies.
When your work at the Historical Society, the Preservation Society, do you work with people in state government and trying to get things, historical markers put up at certain places along the railway sites, or what used to be the railway sites, or trying to preserve aspects of railroad architecture that might be slated for destruction?
We have not done that per se. My railroad society did put up a historic marker next to the steam engine that's in the park at Centennial Park behind the Parthenon, but we paid for that out of our own pocket, and we did not solicit funds from either the city, the state, or anyone else.
We is the are the proceeds from the book going to go to the society at all, or is it going to go to Terry Coates?
Well, right now I only printed 250 copies the first go around, and my actual out of pocket expenses are way over what it's cost. I never realized what it cost to write a book, how expensive it was. So right now the funds are going to my pocket.
But that's always the way it is with a labor of love. If there's something that you've just got to do, then it seems like the average guy has got to go in debt to do it. If you don't have Random House or Simon & Schuster behind you. The book is called Next Stop on Grandpa's Road, History and Architecture of NCNSL, St. L, Railway Depots and Terminals. That's a long... Just remember Next Stop on Grandpa's Road, okay? If you're Googling, by Terry L. Coates, that's spelled C-O-A-T-S, you can get it on Amazon.com, I
take
it? No,
but you can go to my website. It's www.nctldepots.com.
NCSTLDepots.com. Thanks for being our guest today, Terry.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at MTSUnews.com. And we're available on iTunes.